You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to our latest look at the American League Central. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this week, things are getting serious in the division race. The Tigers got hot, the Indians went cold, and suddenly it's a tight battle atop the Central. I'll talk to Jordan Bastian and Jason Beck to get the latest on the Tribe and Tigers. We'll also check in on some big-picture questions facing the Royals, White Sox, and Twins. Let's get to it. I'm joined by the fabulous Scott Merkin. Merk, how you been, buddy? I was off last week, so I didn't get to run down the trade deadline recap with you, but obviously some big-picture questions faced this organization at this trade deadline, and really those conversations or those questions were tabled until the winter. Seems like just in general, kind of a lot of unfinished business and a lot of unsettled situations as far as what the next step is for this franchise.
Yeah, you know, Rick was asked on the conference call, I think I might have asked him actually about, you know, can they say they're going in a rebuild or are they still trying to, you know, kind of go for it? And he said, out of respect to the players and coaches and Robin, who are, you know, working daily to get things done right now, that he wasn't going to give an answer one way or the other on that. So, you know, I think that's still up in the air. If I had to guess, I would say, you know, they're going more towards a rebuild. One thing he did say is they're, you know, they're done with the kind of piecing it together type of plan, which that's kind of the old, you know, revamp while contending type of thing. And again, I think a lot of people outside the organization, a lot of fans were angered that there was no move made before the non-waiver deadline. But I think they weren't getting what they wanted, and there's no point to make a trade just to make a trade. You know, I know people say, well, you know, you can just trade David Robertson for a minor leaguer and, you know, get his money off the books or whatever. But, I mean, he's still a pretty valuable closer, and there's still maybe a move made for him during the waiver period, or he may be around still. I mean, it's just they really didn't have to trade anyone. There were no expiring contracts or no bad deals or no free agents to be. So, you know, they didn't, and they moved forward, and we'll see what they do as, you know, the end of the month comes around, the end of August comes around, and more so the offseason, what goes on then.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating because obviously some very huge trade chips in that rotation in particular. See which direction the White Sox go with that.
Yeah, I still think that Sale or Quintana, one of the main reasons they didn't go anywhere, well, first, because they're so valuable to the team as players, yeah. But B, I think they were asking for major league pieces. I don't think it was, you know, just
right. Give
us a lot of prospects. I think they wanted, you know, Nomar Mazara from Texas or Mookie Betts from Boston, and understandably those teams have relied on those guys to contend to get to where they are now, as one of the pieces to get to where they are now. So they're not going to trade them now, but maybe if, you know, Rickon reapproaches it in December, they are willing to make that move to get a Chris Sale or Jose Quintana. So it'll be, like you said, it'll be interesting to see. There's a lot, you know, not just those two guys, but, you know, pretty much everyone, Abreu, Frazier, Eaton, a lot of interesting pieces that could really kind of revamp the system if you went in that direction.
Well, another interesting piece in the rotation, of course, under contract for another couple years, and the James Shields experience, Merk, has been all over the map. Of course, the three absolutely brutal outings to start his White Sox career. Then he had six straight quality starts, and he had a rough one in Detroit last week, and then he goes bad again in a major way against the Orioles on Sunday. Eight runs on four homers and 1 1/3 innings. And, you know, even when he had the six straight quality starts, it wasn't like he was overpowering people by any means. That's not his game anyway. But, boy, when he goes bad, Mark, he goes so bad. We've seen that, you know, several times now since he's come over to Chicago.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that he hasn't really had, I think, the one start in Boston, which was after, you know, the three horrible ones that started his tenure with the White Sox, was about the only one that's been kind of, you know, midway, like five innings, three runs. You know, not bad, not great,
right.
But, you know, survived. And otherwise, it's been really good or really off the mark. And, yeah, he got hit hard against Baltimore. Yeah, he doesn't throw, you know, 95, 97. So when he's missing his location and the ball's cutting back over the plate, he's going to get, you know, smacked around a little bit. Now, Manny Machado has done that to a lot of people this year, but still, you know, three home runs in three innings. Not all, two of them against James Shields and one against Matt Albers. You don't see that too often. But, yeah, I mean, it was not being glib, but it was kind of batting practice. They hit him hard, and he knew it, and he said it after the game. You know, again, that's another thing that I think fans don't particularly love at this point, hearing that, you know, it's my fault, I'm going to get better. I think they want you to be good at that point. But he understood, you know, I mean, he is missing his spots badly and getting hit pretty hard. And that's been the problem with, you know, Shields, is he's kind of been like a fifth starter in that he's, you know, had some really good ones and some really bad ones. And like you said, the good ones haven't been overpowering, but they've gotten the job done. You know, he's gone 7 innings, 8 innings, 1 runner, 2 runs. But when they've been bad, they've been really off the mark.
Well, let's talk about something positive. Jose Abreu has shown some power of late. He had 3 homers in a 4-game stretch. Prior to that, he had not gone deep since June 25th. So here's a guy who definitely was overdue and seems to be showing that. What have you seen from Abreu here lately?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing with him, and he's talked about this a couple times, is when he expands the strike zone, when he's chasing pitches out of the zone, and that really could be the case for any hitter, but especially for Abreu, then that just kind of, you know, puts him in a hole, and he's, I think, been swinging more at his pitch. And again, I didn't think he was, you know, completely done as a power hitter. I think he just had a really rough stretch, and, you know, I'm not sure if this is part of the situation, but his son has come over from Cuba for a month, and he's spending time with him now. I believe he's going to be with him in Kansas City and then in Miami, too, where, you know, Jose lives in the Florida area in the off season. So maybe that's, you know, maybe that has played on his mind. I don't know. I don't want to speak for him, but I would think that, you know, he hadn't seen him at all since he had come over to play for the White Sox of the United States. Then he did see his son when he went to Cuba for the Goodwill Tour in the off season. And maybe, you know, seeing him kind of made him miss him even more than he already had, which is a pretty high level to begin with. So, who knows, maybe knowing that he was coming helped him a little bit. But I think just sticking to baseball stuff, it's just he's not, you know, as Robin said, his hands look better, and he's just not chasing pitches as much as he was and making hard contact again.
Hey, everybody, thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kasperman, and this is our weekly look at the Cleveland Indians. I am joined by George and Bastian live from Washington, D.C., from what museum you at?
I'm at the Air and Space Museum. It's awesome. I came here with my dad when I was a kid, and I don't remember it. So I came back today so I would remember it, and it's just as good as I don't remember it being when I was little.
Yeah, I can remember popping in. You know, D.C. is like the greatest city to be an intern, as I was, 14 years ago now. When you're a broke intern, living on dollar Big Macs, and you have all these free museums laying around. That's a big help. All right. So a lot has happened with the Indians since we last spoke. JB, I was off last week. A lot of trade deadline activity to sort through, of course, and I'm sure you talked about that on last week's podcast. But I wasn't there, so it doesn't count. But really, I think the bigger issue right now is just the starting staff. It's got an ERA north of 9 in the month of August. Obviously, this is the team's signature strength. It's the reason you feel good about it. If you get to October, it's going to have some rough stretches here and there, but it's been a particularly rough stretch. And I know the big question associated with this has been the catching situation and how much has Yan Gomes' absence paved the way to these starting struggles. I know you've dug into the numbers a little bit. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, 8 days ago, nobody was emailing me asking how much Yan Gomes was missed behind the plate. So it's funny. You know, he got hurt in mid-July, and then for the rest of July, the starting staff went on without missing a beat. I actually wrote a little bit about how Roberto Perez and Corey Kluber had really found, something that they didn't have last year when they worked together briefly. I think Corey Kluber has a 1.55 ERA with Roberto Perez, even through the last week of rotation issues. I think you can kind of just chalk it up to a bad week. I mean, Salazar came down with the injury. Some other guys have, you know, laid some eggs in terms of starts. And then all of a sudden the numbers get really bloated and people start wondering if it's the catchers. But like I said, they had for the rest of July after Gomes went out, I think it was a mid-3 ERA, very respectable showing, kind of right on par with where it was with Yan Gomes. So I think, hey, hopefully it's just a bad week. Every rotation, no matter how talented, goes through great weeks and goes through bad weeks. And I think for the Indians' sake, they can hope this is just one of those rough patches and things, you know, are going to kind of line back up here with a rotation that's kind of too talented to keep performing this way.
Yeah, you'd have to imagine it rounds back into shape, but the catching situation is obviously it remains a major issue right now.
Right.
And we said it going into the trade deadline is going to be very likely to be Jonathan Lucroy or bust. And as it turns out, it's bust because Lucroy rejected the trade, and we'll talk about that in a second. Yeah, you expect that the starting staff will round into form in one way or another, but the catching situation is still an issue. Roberto Perez is not performing offensively, of course, since he's replaced Gomes, and no really on the cusp option down at AAA. What do you see now that Jonathan Lucroy is off the table and of course, rejected the trade, ends up with Texas? What do you see for the catching situation here these next few weeks until Gomes gets back?
Yeah, well, I do think it was kind of Jonathan Lucroy or bust, you know, at that trade deadline. His option for next year was so affordable, being just over $5 million, and he was the type of guy that they felt not only would give them a huge offensive lift, but maybe wouldn't have them missing a beat defensively. You know, he's a guy who is, you know, very well regarded for his game calling and pitch framing and defensive ability behind the plate. And the defensive side is one area where the Indians really do like their catchers, their tandem of Perez and Jimenez and Gomes before that. You know, when you look at what they've done offensively, it's been the worst in baseball in terms of the catching position. But you look at what they've done defensively, you know, the advanced metrics, you know, put them near the top of the American League. So they want to make sure with this pitching staff that they have a group that, you know, the pitching staff likes to throw to, and that is the case with both Roberto Perez and with Chris Jimenez. So that's where a guy like, you know, a lot of people have written in about Brian McCann, where I don't really see him as a fit, not only for the big salary that he has over the next 2 and potentially 3 years, but because he would kind of be a defensive step backward from the group that they have right now, you know, even though he would be an offensive upgrade. So I think the reality with Roberto Perez is he didn't get the type of rehab assignment that they'd want. Yan Gomes' injury kind of forced the Indians' hand, and he was brought back a little early, and we've seen him kind of go through that quote-unquote spring training of sorts as he's tried to get his legs back under him and get used to playing, you know, that full type of major league workload. So, you know, yeah, it hasn't been great, but I really don't see them adding a catcher at this point. I think it is going to kind of be, you know, this group going forward, especially because the rotation and the bullpen and everybody just enjoys working with these guys so much and values what they bring behind the plate.
As you mentioned, it was Lucroy or bust for the Tribe in the trade market before the non-waiver deadline. And curious to get your reaction to Lucroy's discussion of why he did reject this particular trade. He was, of course, concerned about 2017 playing time when Gomes is back and how that would affect him in free agency the following winter. It certainly seemed the Indians were surprised by that because obviously they were giving up quite a bit to get Lucroy, so they had every intention of playing him. But it maybe came down to how they were going to utilize him. I don't know what they communicated to Lucroy. We're, of course, not we weren't flies on the wall for that conversation, but you know, it seems to me he's most valuable behind the plate. He probably would have seen considerable time behind the plate. I don't know if there's some miscommunication here or what, but what were your thoughts on how that all played out?
Yeah, I definitely think there was some miscommunication. I mean, Mike Chernoff, the GM of the Indians, said that they never spoke directly to Lucroy. Lucroy, when he did his, he wrote, you know, the whole story from his perspective, had mentioned that his agent spoke with Chris Antonetti. And, you know, so maybe there was some miscommunication there. But, I mean, let's face it. You look at what Yan Gomes has done this year. Even though he's under contract for next season, you know, the guy's batting 160, and you're bringing in a two-time All-Star, one of the top five catchers in the big leagues. You know, he's not going to be a backup. And I don't totally buy also the idea that it would hurt his value if he spent time in other positions. If anything, the Indians would be keeping his legs fresh if he spent some time at first in DH. And not only that, he would get more at-bats than a typical catcher would. So I think you would be looking at a situation where maybe he would have been the number one catcher as well as a guy who could spend time at other positions to get at-bats. You know, and not only would that, for the long-term, you know, health of a catcher perhaps be, you know, better for a long-term contract, but, you know, like I said, you'd be getting more plate appearances in a season, you know, in order to maximize that offensive production. So I don't really buy the idea that it would have hurt his free agent value if he would have moved to other positions. And I don't think 29 other teams would have just forgotten that he was a top five catcher in baseball if Yan Gomes was spending some of the time or splitting some of the time catching. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting situation. You know, I don't think anybody will ever really know, you know, what went behind it. You know, he was underpaid when you look at what his option is for next year in terms of where he was in terms of other catchers in the league, but it's his contract and it's what he signed. So, but I guess along with that, within that contract, he had the right to veto a trade to eight teams, and he exercised that right and ended up on a playoff contender in the Rangers. So, you know, he got his wish. The Indians didn't get theirs. It'll be interesting to see if the Indians and Rangers meet up in the playoffs.
Michael Fulmer was good again on Monday night. Not good enough, because he'd have been darn near perfect with no offensive help. But this guy's made 18 starts since he debuted. He's given up more than three runs only three times and only once since May 15th. Monday marked his third consecutive quality start. I was kind of putting together this, we've been doing these articles this week, just kind of taking an early look at the awards races. And for me, I mean, Michael Fulmer is the clear American League Rookie of the Year in my eyes. I'm sure Brad Ausmus would agree. Just kind of overall thoughts on Fulmer and how he's blossomed this year.
Yeah, I thought Monday in Seattle, it was a really good example of how far Fulmer has come, because the Mariners had that second inning where they put their couple runs across, and it looked like he was going to be in trouble. He was having some long grab bats. That pitch count got up a little bit. And then he went off and just did what he's done all year, kind of went back into that mode where he's firing strikes, getting relatively quick outs, and he ends up going seven innings, which is incredible. I would have thought after a couple of innings he was in line for, you know, maybe five and done. And to give seven innings to that team on that night, I think said a lot about how far Fulmer's come as a pitcher and what he means to this roster. You know, talking about it with people last week, it's not just what he's done for this rotation. As incredible as it is to think that the only reason he got called up at the end of April was because Shane Green ended up on the DL.
Right.
But, you know, he not only solved that spot and really stabilized the rotation, he helped stabilize the bullpen because they were able to put Shane Green into that right-handed setup role once Green came back from that blister. So he really solved two critical spots on the Tigers pitching staff with one call-up.
And that's been so essential, obviously, settling the pitching staff in general, and it's helped allow the Tigers to go on this run in which they are, you know, knocking on the door in the AL Central and, you know, sneaking up on the Indians. But with that, of course, comes the question about Fulmer's innings, and it seems like Ausmus is pretty certain they'll be able to avoid one of those Strasburgian September shutdowns with Fulmer, but they do have to still be careful, I would imagine, with his pitch counts here in the season's waning weeks.
Yeah, and they start taking a little bit of a different tactic on how to monitor his workload. I think they're looking more at pitches and pitch counts rather than innings right now, because his innings have been relatively efficient really for more than a month now, which is incredible for a rookie. And I think they're looking at that in the combination of off days and the ability to, you know, maybe not so much skip Fulmer at this point with the division and wild card races, you know, coming on strong, but maybe push him back some days here and there where, you know, you can maybe buy him some time and maybe not have to use him quite as much. It may put him in a position where he might be in line for some more efficient starts, maybe get him some extra rest on occasion. A large part, I think, too, is going to depend on how Jordan Zimmerman comes back, when he comes back, what you can expect out of him. Kyle Freer could have a little bit of a role in that. You know, once you get one or both of those guys back, maybe you keep some of the other guys in for an extra start, maybe buy Sanchez an extra start so you don't have to keep Fulmer on turn that particular time around the order. But we'll see. They sound a little bit more creative and a little bit more willing to get creative to try to keep him in their rotation for the full year. I don't think they can afford to be without him down the stretch right now, the way it's shaping up.
Yeah, you mentioned Zimmerman's neck injury that has him on the DL currently, and injury wave. It's club once again here. just as things are going so well in the one loss column, they're losing some bodies along the way. Cameron Maben injured his thumb last week. Nick Castellanos is a big one. He's out indefinitely with a broken bone in his left hand. So it's kind of the yin and yang right now, but kind of that they're winning ball games and losing players.
Yeah, it's funny to think that just, you know, a little bit over a week ago, they were looking at Cleveland and thinking, here's a shorthanded team that's vulnerable. And now you look at two pretty big spots in the Tigers lineup, and with Castellanos out until September at least, and Cameron Maben having a hard time getting back from that thumb injury, this is a different-looking lineup right now. I know Tyler Collins has filled in admirably in Maben's absence, but you know, the longer this goes, the tougher I think that gets. And I think when you look at what Maben was bringing to that lineup from that second spot, that's tough to replicate. Whether even if you do have a hot-hitting Tyler Collins, I think that speed factor is difficult to find elsewhere on that roster, and that dynamic type of play he provided offensively and defensively. And Castellanos, you know, it's, as somebody pointed out, it's kind of funny to think now when you look back at how we looked at his career to date going into the season, that we're looking at him as a critical bat to be without for the next 4 to 6 weeks. It says a lot about how far he's progressed, but I think it also says a lot about how difficult it's going to be to try to replace him. You're looking at the classic example of why they tried to build up depth in the minor leagues through six-year free agent signings to try to protect themselves in case of injuries like this. And lo and behold, we're trying to figure out if Casey McGee was going to find his way back onto this roster somehow, and here it is. He's the guy.
Jeffrey, a lot of big picture questions now with the Royals, with the way 2016 has kind of gone off the rails here in recent weeks, and certainly seems even a wild card spot is in serious doubt at this point. But it does get you thinking about the future roster composition, and probably the biggest source of intrigue is over at third base, because Chesler Cuthbert has performed so well with Mike Moustakas on the shelf. Moose, of course, will be back in 2017. Then you got Hunter Dozier looming in Triple-A as another option at the hot corner. It all kind of makes you wonder how this all sorts itself out, and maybe do the Royals shop Moustakas this winter in advance of his free agency. What are your thoughts, big picture, at that particular position?
Yeah, pretty good problem to have. I mean, go back a few years ago, and Ned Yost was joking that as he stuck with Moose through some pretty tough times, saying, well, we don't exactly have a third base tree. Just flick some guys off. But evidently now they do. A lot of depth there. Chesler's played so well in his rookie year here, his first full rookie year, that you got to believe they're going to try to find a spot for him somewhere next year on the major league roster. So they will have most likely, the DH spot available, depending on how they feel about Kendrys Morales going into next year. But without doubt, when Moose comes back, he obviously reclaims a job. He's one of the better third basemen in baseball. He's got a lot of pop. I don't really necessarily think they'd be shopping him in the offseason, just because of they really want to make a run in 2017, and he's an integral part of that. And you can make the case that one of the reasons they've slipped back so badly this year is just the missing his emotional leadership. He's always been kind of the rah-rah guy in the dugout. So I suspect he comes back. They'll either maybe try Chesler at second base or something like that. He's a pretty good athlete. He could probably handle that if they needed to, the DH. And then, of course, Hunter Dozier, who had his breakthrough season, former first-round pick in the minors this year. I think he's got combined double-A, triple-A. He's got 21 or 22 home runs and hitting over 300, really high on-base percentage, too. So they've already started that transition. They've moved him to right field at Omaha and getting in some time at the corner outfield spots there. So in case they, he continues to emerge, that's an option for him. But it's definitely a nice problem to have, and definitely something that, maybe there is a trade chip there, maybe with a Hunter Dozier down the line.
Well, speaking of trade chips, of course, the Royals had a few pending free agents at the deadline. They did not move, and Luke Hochaver, of course, got hurt. Thoracic outlet syndrome surgery, that's such a bummer for a guy who you know, worked so hard to get back to this point. But Kendrys Morales and Enison Volquez both had value in this marketplace. The Royals keep both of those guys. They have mutual options on them for 17, and as we've discussed in this podcast, there's no reason to suspect that, especially on the player side, that those will be exercised. So what are your thoughts on Morales and Volquez and the possibility they'll still be in Royals uniforms in some capacity in 2017?
Yeah, those are going to be really interesting questions in the offseason because, especially with Eddie Volquez, you know, he's a guy who can really, you know, eat a lot of innings up. He's going to get up near, I guess, 180, 200 again this year. And this is not a team that, as you know, is has a lot of depth right now with the starting pitching. And you've got three main guys coming back, and Kennedy, Duffy, and Ventura. But, you know, you've got two open spots there. And Eddie's proven that he can stay healthy. He's not having a fantastic year, but maybe he finishes strong, and they strongly consider bringing him back at, you know, some kind of, hopefully for them, discounted rate for the next 2 years or so. With Morales, it's even a tougher question because, you know, he's a guy that gives them pop. Right now he leads the team in home runs with 18, and they just don't have a lot of pop in that lineup. But do you go out and give him another 10 to 12 million to come back for another year? He's getting up there in age. That ties into the Chesler Cuthbert question. You know, there was a time that they thought the DH spot could be kind of a roving spot where they give everybody kind of a, you know, one or two games at the DH spot a week, and so maybe that's what they turn to in 17, and they let Kendrys go. I'm guessing they'll probably offer both QOs, so you know that maybe they can steal a draft pick out of them if they both leave. So really up in the air whether those guys come back, but I'd say a better percentage that Eddie comes back.
The Twins, it's definitely under the category of too little too late as it pertains to the race, but it's certainly good for the soul that this club is 21-13 since the beginning of July. That's the second best record in the majors during that span. They also lead the majors with 199 runs scored in that span. So kind of, I mean, this is kind of the club they expected to be going into the season. They expected to have a strong offense, especially, and it took a long time to get to this point, but here they are.
Yeah, exactly. Like you said, it's kind of too little too late. This team started off 10-33, which is too big of a hole to climb out of, but they have been playing a lot better baseball really over the last 2 months or so, a little bit above 500, as you said, obviously, since July 1st. Second best record in the majors, tied for the most wins, a nice stretch there, and the offense has really been getting going. You know, it kind of seems like when Brian Dozier started to kind of click offensively with his power and everything, was kind of when the team kind of started to turn a little bit. We've seen some younger guys contribute. You know, even guys like Eddie Rosario coming back up, you know, swung back pretty well. Kenny Vargas in limited time, Jorge Polanco in limited time. Miguel Sano starting to kind of at least have a bounce back after a little bit of a talking to, it seemed like last Friday, had a nice weekend there in Tampa. And Joe Mauer's been doing, you know, really well. Obviously, him and Kepler being the AL co-players of the week. Kepler's been a big part of this offensive turnaround. So, yeah, I think the big thing is the offense. The pitching's been a little bit more consistent. Still had some, you know, troubles there in the rotation a little bit. Guys like Duffy have struggled. Obviously, Malone went to the bullpen. Gibson's kind of been up and down. But at least the offense has given them a chance, and they're starting to play a lot better baseball. And like you said, it really is kind of the team we thought we'd see. You know, it's kind of a team that'd be, you know, at least close to 500 and maybe compete for a wild card spot like last year. And sure enough, with that 10-33 start and 0-9 start, they were pretty much buried before it was even, you know, kind of starting there. So at least now that they're kind of showing signs, which is a good thing because maybe they can build on a strong second half. Going into next year, maybe they really do believe they can compete in 2017.
Well, you mentioned Kepler, and boy, if you would have said going into the season that a Twins outfielder would be in the hunt for the Rookie of the Year award, you'd assume we'd be Byron Buxton. Buxton, of course, was sent down again the other day, and we'll talk about him in a second, but Kepler with the 870 OPS, 15 homers, 13 doubles, he's got a legitimate case for that award, right?
Yeah, he really does, and it's pretty amazing, like you said, just kind of think about even just 2 years ago, I mean, all the hype we always heard about Sano and Buxton, you know, Kepler was always kind of that third wheel kind of in the back, and it was more projection than actual, you know, results. Sure enough, last year he had a breakout year at AA with the Southern League MVP, and, you know, got a small taste of the majors in September call, but I think he only played in one game. But this year, he's really kind of at that breakout year they're hoping for, but I think even he's been doing better than they expected in terms of the power. They always say that, you know, he really backspins the ball. It's kind of the term they use. But he seems to hit really hard line drives, and sure enough, they just seem to carry out of the park. Obviously, he had a huge series there against the Indians, and, you know, a three-home-run game, which was, you know, pretty impressive, especially for a rookie. I think it's only the fifth time in Twins history to have three home runs in a game. So, yeah, he's definitely up in that mix. You got to figure that Tyler Naquin with the Indians, obviously, is in that mix, and maybe even Kim with the Orioles, and Fulmer with the Tigers is having a great rookie year. I think he's going to be ninth in the ERA right now. So it's going to be an interesting race, but no one's really kind of separating themselves. There's definitely 2 months left. If Kepler keeps it going and finishes, you know, with all these home runs and, you know, doubles with the kind of speed he has, he certainly has a really strong case.
And, of course, Buxton sent back down and still no tangible improvements at the plate at the big league level. How worrisome is this, Rhett?
At this point, it's starting to become a little more worrisome. And the thing is, at the same time, though, he's only 22 years old. So we've seen guys, we've seen Jackie Bradley Jr., we've seen guys do this before, plenty, kind of have a slow start to their career before they get it going. But for him to be a number one overall prospect for 2 years straight and then kind of go through this is definitely, you know, pretty rare and definitely worrisome just because more than anything, it's just a contact problem. You know, he's not making contact enough, even on balls in the zone. He's striking out way too much. And with his speed, you know, if he can put the ball in play, he could be, you know, definitely an above-average player, even if he doesn't hit for that much power or that much average. You know, he could hit 260 and still be a really valuable player just because of his speed on defense and his speed on the bases. So for them, I think it's just a matter of either fixing that swing. I don't know if it's the mechanics of the swing that's the issue or if it's just, you know, a little bit of pressure, you know, mentally just because there's been so much, you know, pressure for him to perform now over the last couple of years if that's been an issue. But I think about AAA, that's going to let him, you know, hit the reset button. Maybe work on that swing down there with Chad Allen, the, you know, hitting coach down there who he works with, you know, a lot and has a good relationship with and really helped him even at AA. Maybe he can kind of get that going because it's definitely worrisome because he was a number one overall prospect. They kind of figured he'd at least kind of figured it out by now. It was clear that he got rushed to the majors last year. But I thought maybe this, you know, kind of final stint, you know, recently that he maybe started to get it going and it really hasn't happened.
And where are we with Sano? You mentioned showed improvement over the weekend in Tampa Bay. Also had probably the most impressive pop-out in Major League history when he hit that ball off the Tropicana Field roof, first player to do that. But, of course, you know, there was a lot of talk of a potential demotion of Sano last week, so that was all kind of surrounding him and seems to be responding to it so far.
Yeah, it kind of all started with you know, hitting coach Tom Bernanski telling 1500 ESPN over the air that Sano kind of needed to match his, you know, work ethic with his, you know, skills that he has because he's obviously incredibly talented. You know, all-star caliber type hitter. But I think there was a little bit of question that maybe just kind of, you know, not that he's lazy or anything, but, you know, there was, he missed, you know, an early batting practice, wasn't quite maybe giving it his all for the kind of talent that he had. And I think the Twins wanted him to kind of focus on being great instead of merely just, you know, very good in a sense. And kind of wanted to push his buttons, it sounded like, you know, kind of going through the media. Mulder didn't disagree with, you know, Bernanski's assertion and kind of, you know, said that he felt like, you know, could, you know, be a little better in that sense. And I think, too, defensively, he's had his, you know, I think, was it 12 errors in 28 games at third base. You know, on the bases, he's made a lot of, you know, running mistakes. Some of it's just being aggressive, but he had to be smarter. Even yesterday, he doubles, you know, shows a lot of hustle getting the second. And then, sure enough, the very next play is a grounder to shortstop, and somehow Sano stands there and gets tagged out by Correa instead of getting back to the bag. I mean, it was a great play by Correa. He's a great shortstop. But it was another one of those boneheaded plays where you're like, that's kind of like a, you know, a little league thing. Don't get, you know, don't try to advance on a ground ball to short when you're at second base. So little things like that, I think he kind of needs to pay attention to things a little bit more and focus. But the skills are definitely there. And then, like you said, that series and Tampa really got it going offensively. And that pop fly that hit the top of the roof there was pretty incredible. Just like last year, he was in Tampa and he hit that catwalk. Remember that was, you know,
yeah.
I think it was the B-ring, whatever it was. And it wasn't a home run, but it definitely would have been. So that stadium definitely has had some interesting adventures there with Miguel Sano in it.